What's wrong with higher education today? According to our guest this week, Ben Nelson, lots of things that his organization, Minerva Schools KGI, is taking head-on as they endeavor to reimagine what the higher education experience is all about. Ben is the founder of Minerva and a visionary whose model for higher education I'm already hoping my own children can pursue when they come of age. We look forward to sharing that with you today. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My co-host is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 9 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. The origins of modern university education in the West go back to the 11th century in Bologna, Italy. Rooted in Christian education and an extension of monastic education, which itself was adopted from Buddhist traditions in the Far East, higher education was an oasis of knowledge for the privileged few. Integrated into cities such as Paris, Oxford, and Prague, while the university was its own place and space, it lived within and as part of a larger city and community. The focus was on the arts, capital A, a term used very differently than we think about it today, and including all or a subset of seven arts: arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, music theory, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. The university experience of today looks very different. Students expect to live on a campus, set away from the larger city or community around it. The number of subjects has exploded, with arts and sciences representing just one college within a university, and one that, for some decades, has been diminished in importance compared to more practical and applied knowledge, such as business and engineering. A higher proportion of citizens than ever now attend an institute of higher learning, with knowledge having been democratized substantially, even as it becomes increasingly essential to merely eking out a simple living. And, in most cases, the religious roots of universities in general, or your school in particular, have been hidden or downplayed as our world becomes increasingly secular. These changes have taken place in different paces and ways over about 1,000 years. While the differences are significant and reflect the ways in which knowledge and civilization have evolved, given the magnitude of time involved, we might even consider the changes modest. However, the next wave of significant innovation looks like it will be more extreme. In the upcoming decades, we can expect the confluence of the internet, smartware technologies, and ever-increasing knowledge about ourselves, the human animal, how we learn, how we live, how we participate in a liberal global society of connected people, to revolutionize education. In fact, the breadcrumbs for these changes are already here, right before us. Ben Nelson is the founder of Minerva Schools at KGI. I found their philosophy and structure to be an inspiring glimpse into where even the largest and most staid universities will be forced to head. Let's begin as Ben frames the problems with modern higher education.
I could categorize the problems in one meta issue, and then there are various manifestations of it. So the meta issue is that colleges and universities are trying to be everything to everybody. And when, you know, if you were to create any kind of enterprise and say, oh, let's, you know, serve the needs of many different constituencies, oftentimes with conflicting wants, then you would create a lot of problems. And the thing that people don't understand about the college and university system when they look at it from the outside is that the currency of higher education isn't money. It's not a generally profit-driven set of organizations. It isn't outcomes, unfortunately. It really is all about prestige. Prestige drives the world of academia. It drives individual members within academia, right? Professors who are striving for the Nobel Prize or for tenure or for publications in major magazines and everything that actually is related to the other. And the decisions that the institutions themselves make is a collection of other elements of prestige. And so when you think about all of those forces that are pushing universities, the thing that unfortunately gets compromised the most is education. Because the educating of students doesn't generate prestige nearly as much as the selection process of the students, the careers and research careers of the professors, the amenities that the university can boast about, the beautiful campus, the sports programs, et cetera. And so what happens is that education becomes, forget a second-class citizen, you're even a third-class citizen, in many ways an afterthought. And because of that, the university system all over the world continue to provide a service that is suboptimal, to say the least. And that really is, I think, at the core of all of the problems of higher education.
There are certainly schools today that have more of a teaching focus than a research focus. In fact, most universities are not realistically expecting Nobel Prizes from their faculty. Still, the overarching point that the drive for prestige is warping the effectiveness of learning environments is certainly valid. In our current reward system, prestige fuels everything. Along with earning prizes, it also improves the quality of the applicant pool, it enables the solicitation of higher tuition and rates, and it brings in more accomplished faculty who have advantages in further raising the prestige, thus creating a virtuous circle. Of course, prestige is not an entirely bad thing. Lower prestige institutions such as community colleges, even as they tend to prioritize teaching and learning in their own missions, actually suffer from significantly worse retention and graduation rates than those at the top of the prestige hierarchy. So, to best deliver on a promise of top education, the prestige matters because it attracts the students most likely to make the most of the opportunity. Like most things in life, it's complicated. Having heard Ben identify the problem, let's get into what he is trying to do at Minerva.
We are an educational institution first and foremost. Now, there are things that you need to do if you are providing an education in residence, as we do. Our students all live together and they have a residential experience. And so obviously you have to make sure that the students are safe, right? That they have some infrastructure to make sure that you guide them on how to navigate the world, especially in the Minerva instantiation, that you provide them some co-curricular opportunities, ways for them to experience the world around them, et cetera. But at the same time, we do that with the view of educating and growing our students. And so rather than thinking about student safety as a silo, saying, oh my God, let's just keep students safe. So the easiest way to do that is just put them in jail, right? So you can just build a castle, put them in, you know, generate moats and armed guards and make sure nobody gets in so the students are safe, at least from the outside world, you know, but who knows from one another. Mm-hmm. Instead, we look at it as, well, these students are going to graduate, and forget graduating, during the summer, they're going to go out and do an internship, maybe halfway around the world. They actually need to know how to keep themselves safe. They need to learn how to have some street smarts. They have to learn how to navigate new environments. They have to learn what smart behavior is versus what's pretty stupid behavior. And so everything we do is trying to provide that level of focus for students. But what we don't do is we don't have a campus. We have residence halls where students live, but they're in the middle of the world's most vibrant cities. And so we don't need to build an alternate reality that not only costs an enormous amount of money, but has all sorts of other pulls and pushes from society. We don't offer cafeterias. We don't offer gyms. There are plenty of ways for you to eat and exercise in the real world. We don't have intercollegiate athletic programs. On the one hand, Minerva students have a relatively similar experience to more of the large urban universities. So, for example, if you think of a Columbia or an NYU, and this is especially the case for NYU, which is really integrated into the city, but even in Columbia, students that spend a lot of time on that campus are kind of missing the point. They're in Manhattan. They should probably take advantage of being in Manhattan, and most students do. The fact that Columbia offers the whatever infrastructure they offer on campus is in many ways a waste because students will spend the bulk of their time in the real world. And so our students have the same type of day-to-day experience. The only difference is that they're learning to adult a little bit faster, right? So whereas in most universities, still the center of gravity is the frat party and, you know, I go to the cafeteria and everybody takes care of me in the day-to-day, at Minerva, yes, you're living together, you're in a residence hall like in other universities, you have residential life, et cetera, but breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you have to cook. You're cooking for yourself. You have to actually manage a life, much like you would when you're an adult or when you're out working over a summer in a summer internship. And so the day-to-day experience is very much a modern city living with the overhead of actually having a live-in staff member that you can turn to, that you can get advice from, infrastructure around mental health and student support, and the kinds of guardrails that allow you to learn to adult faster. And that's kind of on the day-to-day.
The word that comes to mind is maturity. Minerva is treating their students like adults, even as they prepare them for adulthood. Here in the United States, we have long traditions of the university experience marked by things like sports teams, fraternities and sororities, and the self-contained nature of the living and working environments. Once upon a time, when cars and airplanes were not affordable and accessible tools for travel, this approach allowed a community to develop. Now, the institutions of campus life remain, but in a world where many students access regional professional sports teams for entertainment, local apartments that offer freedom compared to dormitory or Greek life, and the wider array of superior food and shopping options beyond the campus gates. What was once a community has evolved into, taking the most pessimistic perspective, infantilization. Minerva's approach is at once modern and empowering. Let's learn about their educational learning philosophy.
If you think about a traditional education in a university, college or university, you think about it in a conglomeration of really independent units. You take 30 courses while you're in school. There are 30 different professors who teach these courses. Those professors really don't coordinate with one another very much. In fact, they have no idea what the makeup of their student body is within their particular class. Maybe certain students will have taken courses XYZ, other students will have taken courses ABC. Sometimes there are prerequisites, but even when there are, I'm sure you've all been in classes in college where in the first 2 or 4 weeks of a class, a professor will feel compelled to do the entire previous semester's worth of material just in case you didn't actually learn it. And the nature of that education is very much on a unitized basis. So that's one aspect. The second aspect of a traditional university is that it really is oriented towards the dissemination of information. Even at the most prestigious universities in the country, the majority of credits that are issued by a university are in lecture-based format. So students come in, a professor speaks for all or the overwhelming majority of the time. Even when a professor will take questions, the lecture effectively passes from one professor to one student, and the majority of students are sitting passively in class. So there are two problems with these two models. Curricularly, from a curricular design perspective, the world doesn't work in discrete parts of subject-based knowledge. The world isn't divided into physics in isolation from biology in most cases, or politics isolated from economics in all cases, etc. And so the learning of discrete pieces of information isn't very much related to the way the world works. And it's also, by the way, not related to the way people think.
Ben is espousing a connected education, one that leverages the information sharing power of the internet with a systems thinking approach that sees the importance of connecting each part of the experience together. I remember in my own undergraduate studies, the only tool I had to navigate the central planning of my education was my guidance counselor. A very nice and interested woman for whom I was one of hundreds, if not thousands, of students she was responsible for. She would not even remember me from one meeting to the next, separated by a semester or even a year. And while she was attempting to help me centrally manage my education, her guidepost was graduation requirements, not knowledge optimization and holistic growth. It was a generic industrial process. It also had no influence from learning theory, much less considering my own optimal environments to learn.
When we think about somebody who is wise or can think about appropriate applications of practical knowledge to particular situations, we think of somebody who has learned lessons in one context and applies them to another. Mm-hmm. And when you deliver education in discrete packages, it turns out the brain has a very hard time with understanding that. Secondly, when you're sitting in an environment where you're passively receiving information, the retention in the brain of that information is minuscule. So study after study has shown that a typical test and lecture-based class, within 6 months of the end of the semester, students have forgotten 90% of what they knew, which basically means it's just ineffective. And so we change both of these aspects. First, we create a curriculum and a delivery mechanism that ensures that your education isn't looked at on a course-by-course basis, but is looked at from a curricular perspective. And the way we do that is that we codify dozens of different elements, learning objectives, that we refer to as habits of mind or foundational concepts. Habits of mind are things that become automatic with practice, and foundational concepts are things that are generative, things that once you learn, you can build off of in many different ways. And then these learning objectives get introduced in one course in a particular context. They then get presented in different contexts in the very same course, and then they show up in courses throughout the curriculum in new contexts again until you have learned generalizable learning objectives, which means that you have learned things conceptually and the ways to apply them practically in multiple contexts, which means that when you encounter original situations, original contexts, you'll be able to know what to do in those situations.
While connected technologies are an enabler of this approach, just as important is the knowledge of and will to implement better approaches to learning.
And the second thing that we do is that we make sure that 100% of our classes are fully active. What does fully active mean? It means that our professors aren't allowed to talk for more than 4 minutes at a time. The lesson plans are structured in such a way that the professor's job is really to facilitate novel application from students on what they have studied, their homework, novel idea, and actually use class time to further the intellectual development of the students. And so we do this because we're able to do this because we've built an entirely new learning environment where our students, even though all of our classes are small, less than 20 students per class, we conduct all of our formal educational environments or formal education classes online via live video. So a professor and 15 students get together from 9 to 10:30 on Mondays and Wednesdays. And during that hour and a half, students are constantly at the edge of their seats applying what it is that they have studied outside of class into new contexts. And so Minerva courses are extremely engaging. They're very intensive. They're integrative in the sense that you bring together different areas of and fields together, and they're effective. The active learning, not even fully active learning, which is what we do, but standard active learning with the same professor that gets 10% retention after 6 months in a lecture and test-based class, same professor, same material, same quality of students, 2 years after the end of an active learning class, students will retain 70% of the information.
Having been 18 and in university, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Ben's vision of students, quote, constantly at the edge of their seat, unquote, is a bit of hyperbole. Nevertheless, the basic idea that these engaged approaches increase interest, retention, and facility certainly holds. And what about the faculty?
So all of the students live together, but the professors are all over the world. We hire professors to be on our staff full time, but we don't let geography constrain them, which is another beauty of having a platform that enables close interaction between professor and student. And that allows for two things. It allows for our professors to be the best in the world in teaching their subjects, and it enables the students to change their location. And that's why at Minerva, students live in 7 different countries by the time they graduate, because they don't have to take the faculty with them. The faculty is accessible anywhere you are in the world. And so it gives our students the opportunity to both have a very deep formal education, as well as the ability to apply that in multiple contexts in the real world.
A friend of mine actually teaches at Minerva from the friendly confines of his home in Watertown, Massachusetts, where exactly none of the students are co-located. He is a champion of the Minerva Way and even connected me to Ben for this interview. Pivoting to technology, let's learn more about how Minerva is putting tech to work.
There are 2 factors in that enable both of these approaches to education. The first one is that we've built a number of fully active learning techniques and methodologies into the platform. So, for example, at any time, a professor can press a button and see how much time each student has spent talking in the class. But rather than showing charts and numbers and things like that, all the professor sees is a color code for each student's video stream. So he'll see some students in green, some in yellow, some in red. And the ones in red means they've talked too much. Don't call on them anymore. The ones in yellow say they've talked about the average amount of time. The ones in green have not talked much at all, and therefore they're the ones that need to be engaged and coaxed out of their shell. What happens when you do that? And another element that we do is that the technology also then enables the professor to go back and, rather than pass a snap judgment on who made a good point or who they thought did well in class, they go back later, listen to the recording of an activity in class or grade a paper and use rubrics to score, which again eliminates a lot of biases that generally favor men when you just ask first impressions of professors, both male and female. What was your perspective on how well someone did? Generally, both male and female professors will overgrade on instinct male responses and undergrade female responses, which is bad for both genders.
Yeah.
And so it creates an environment which is not a very good educational environment.
It's not clear to me that this is better for any one specific teacher compared to their using instinct and intuition, but it is certainly better for an institute of higher learning across their faculty. Teaching quality is traditionally inconsistent and unreliable from one professor to the next, to say nothing of the subtle issues of bias that Ben highlights. Connecting the classroom and layering intelligent software on top of the proper hardware infrastructure helps teach best practices to the faculty, even as process and outcomes become standardized. Let's get a deeper sense of the Minerva professors.
On the one hand, the professors on the surface look just like professors at any other elite institution. Great educational background, they have a PhD from the top program, they have interesting research areas, etc. So on the surface, in many ways, they look the same. But there are really 2 fundamental differences in how we screen and prepare our professors, as well as their day-to-day lifestyle. So in how we screen and prepare them, in order to become a professor at Minerva, you actually have to go in front of a class of students and teach. And we observe how it is that you teach. We get feedback from students, and that's how we make the final decision of who gets an offer. And that's important because in a traditional academic environment, academics are rewarded for being very narrow and having a high rigid intelligence. And yep. By that I mean that, right, they're the world's foremost expert on this version of plastics. And they have a particular way of producing these plastics, and their way is the best way. And if a competing researcher has a different way, their job is to bring that researcher down, right? To show that their way is better and they're going to argue for their way, et cetera. So very narrow, very rigid. Whereas what we look for are professors that have very broad interests, because again, we're much more real-world application, and the ones that have very high fluid intelligence. Right? They have a perspective in the world, but if somebody else brings another perspective, what a high fluid intelligence person would do is to listen to the argument, weigh the positives and negative points, and incorporate what makes sense, and then counter what doesn't. So a very different type of perspective. And then even once we screen them, we put them through a month of training on how to do fully active learning, how to engage students, class management, et cetera, which for most professors is the first time they've ever been formally taught how to teach. Because nowhere in your undergraduate, master's, or PhD program, the most students actually go through a process of teaching you how to teach, even though that's theoretically part of their profession. So that's how we screen and train. And then on the day-to-day, professors at Minerva, because of all of the screening and training, generally are full-time. The majority of classes that we offer at Minerva are taught by a full-time faculty. But there are some faculty, for example, that have a very active research program, right? And maybe doing research and a big scientific installation and only have time to teach, you know, half time, which is fine. So we have also some of those professors who don't teach a full load but teach a half load because they're pursuing other types of research or non-classroom activities elsewhere.
One of the admirable characteristics of Minerva is an entrepreneurial commitment to continual improvement.
Yeah, so already every year we've improved and learned from what we're doing and made Minerva better. And we intend to continue doing that every single year. But I think that the biggest step change for Minerva is going to be when a new entrant will come in and create a model that's even better than ours. You know, if you think about the difference between the outcomes that we're employing or deploying with fully active learning versus the standard educational model out there and all of the Ivy League universities, et cetera, the delta or the difference in impact is a bigger impact difference than penicillin was to a sugar pill. I mean, it's actually an absolute step change when you think about it. And we often think of Minerva as penicillin, but penicillin is also a very primitive antibiotic, right? Today, there are so many other antibiotics that are particularly focused on a certain microbial. And our guess is that there are going to be other institutions that will pop up in the future that are going to improve upon what we're doing. And that's going to force us to make other step changes to catch up ourselves. But right now, our hope is that at the very least, until some of those new institutions start up, that we can influence other universities to start rethinking what they're doing about education. And again, I mentioned at the beginning that universities are really driven by prestige. And up until now, prestige has been driven by research. But universities are coming under so much attack from the left and the right because they're in many ways disconnected with their educational purpose, is that and that we believe that the notion of prestige will actually begin to shift and start focusing on outcomes. Universities have been able to get away with it for so long because they've in many ways tricked the rest of the world into believing that research-granted prestige or selectivity-granted prestige equals outcomes-generated prestige. But the fact of the matter is that if you take the Harvard student body and give it to Beacon Hill Community College, and you take the Beacon Hill student body and give it to Harvard, the outcomes will be exactly reversed. It'll be with the students, not with the institution. Because guess what? Beacon Hill Community College and Harvard teach physics in the exact same way. There's no difference, right? And so what universities are currently relied on is just attracting great students. And what we're trying to show is that despite the fact that we attract wonderful students, what we're able to do with them, the preparation that we give them that they can apply in the real world, puts them years ahead of their competitors or peers at other institutions. And so we believe that the more the world sees this, the more the definition of prestige will change to be focused on outcomes. And if that occurs, then not only will you see new entrants adopt Minerva-like models, but you will see existing institutions adopt our model as well.
Ben's realization that the next major step forward will likely be driven by another school trying to compete with Minerva is wise. And their approach is a collaborative one, actively seeking win-win relationships.
Paul, a few months ago, we announced our first partnership with the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, which happens to be the number one ranked young university in the world. That's basically universities started in 1970 or later. And HKUSD, which is not only highly ranked as a young university, but highly ranked in general, extraordinarily prestigious. I think has the number one business program in Asia. I think number one executive MBA in the world. Was the first university to go and say, you know what, we should look at the Minerva model and take a small group of students and then implement this type of curriculum for them, for their general education, and see what happens. And I think that elite universities are actually under an enormous amount of pressure from the external world to demonstrate that it's not just that they're selecting good students, because that's not no longer a novel or hidden trope. It actually is out there, and there's pretty strong evidence. In fact, there's research that showed that if you look at people who were accepted to Harvard but then decided to go to other institutions, including state schools, so long as they come from the top 80% of socioeconomic households in the country, which is something like 90-some percent of students admitted to Harvard, that their life outcomes are exactly the same as those who chose to go to Harvard, which again basically shows that it's the selection process. And so I think the Ivies are under much closer scrutiny for effectively picking good students and then stepping aside as opposed to actually shaping them. And so I do think that you're going to have institutions throughout the spectrum that are going to be adopting the Minerva model, but I don't think it'll be reserved to institutions that are, quote unquote, in the middle of the pack, as opposed to institutions really across the board.
I'm not sure the Ivies are feeling that much pressure yet. Hundreds of thousands of parents around the world, if not millions, would happily get a second mortgage on their home or take other risky financial moves to fund their child's admission in. Ben sees realities and future trends that will emerge but aren't here yet. That's also part of the reason why Minerva is so novel. As much as I certainly find it inspiring and, as a higher education model, more correct in a certain way, the fact that the market is not tacking hard into this model reveals that these are future-forward approaches, not contemporary ones. In speaking with Stephen Anderson and Pam Pedersen in past episodes, alternate reality is a technology they both identified as having exciting educational opportunities. Ben mentions this as well, as he talks about technology and Minerva.
The piece of technology that we have deployed in part, but are going to continue to build on and work on in the very near future, is this idea of the scaffolded curriculum, introducing a particular learning objective and then tracking how that learning objective is applied and mastered across 30 different professors in 4 years. And this doesn't sound like such a radical improvement, but it fundamentally changes the nature of education. Imagine when you think about a person who is wise, the immediate image that you see in your mind is somebody who's old, right? Because they've had decades of experience. They've made the same mistake over and over again in very different contexts, and then they finally learn their lesson. Imagine if the world could produce students who had the analytical capabilities to make wise choices at 22, 23. That's transformational. I mean, it's far more important than, oftentimes people think about technology and education, they'll say, oh, you get to have a virtual reality experience and fly through a pyramid. Okay, who cares, right? I mean, that's not a really impactful. It's great for Hollywood, it's great for sizzle, but how is that really going to change the world? How is that actually going to have dramatic positive impact? Whereas, if you actually shorten the time that humanity needs to acquire wisdom by 30 or 40 years, think about what the world can do. And that, by the way, can only be done with technology. Without technology, you cannot track individual student progress and modify their personalized intellectual development in a classroom environment. You need to have the data. You need to have the data in a way that the professor can react and do something with it. And you, without technology, it's just impossible. It's impossible to collect the data. It's impossible to disseminate it. It's impossible to present it to the professor in real time in a format in which they can use it. And I believe that some of the real opportunities in the future are going to be where augmented reality will effectively replace the need to be on a laptop type interface. I could imagine an augmented reality where you have a classroom of students and a professor in one place, or where you have actually 30 students in 30 different parts of the world having an immersive real life experience with a professor with the data overlay. And I think when you have the opportunity for education to remove boundaries and constraints, you can all of a sudden think very differently about what the nature of education should be. And that empowers humans to come up with solutions that are far, far, far more advanced than what most universities are currently doing. And again, it's how you go from our penicillin to the spectrum of antimicrobials that you'll have in the future in the analogy.
Extending the vision, Ben's endgame isn't about degrees or credentials, but helping make better people.
Right now, granted, I may have been a little bit advanced in my hope for 22 or 23 year olds to have real applied wisdom, even though we're seeing some of that, because the brain really doesn't get overwhelmingly formed until 25 or 26. So you may have to push that back by a couple of years, have full frontal lobe development, etc. So that's an important component. But when you really look at the literature that everything at Minerva is based on, it comes from both aspects of literature around how the mind actually works and how memory gets stimulated and is effective, and that's the fully active learning part. But again, perhaps the more important aspect is literature around what psychologists refer to as far transfer. Now, far transfer is actually a very thinly studied area of research, but it generally shows that it takes many people many decades to attain generalizable critical thinking. And that when you try to teach critical thinking or try to do development of people on generalizable skills within subject, it just doesn't work. So there was a relatively a prominent study in the world of far transfer that wanted to test how people who are considered very good critical thinkers in their field do on general critical thinking types of questions. And so they used air flight controllers, the folks who are having to think on the fly about changing wind conditions and different planes coming in and making some really important on-the-spot critical thinking decisions, and wanted to see how they do on a general critical thinking test. And it turns out they performed in the general test just like an average professional. Really, there was no carryover from one area to another. You can think about brilliant doctors or scientists that you talk to, engage with them in a conversation about politics or economics or things that affect them day to day, about their personal relationships. They're no better critical thinkers than anybody else, right? It's not to say, oh, yes, the best spouses are people who are extraordinarily brilliant economists. I have not seen evidence to that effect, right? I think that's true. And that is a failure of transfer, because many principles that you can apply in critical thinking in a particular field apply broadly in any domain of your life, and that really is the key to education. So if you can shortcut the process of mastering far transfer, you can have a pretty dramatic impact.
And we finish up with Ben's suggestions for how professors can make positive changes in their own institutions.
I would encourage them to begin having moral conversations in their institutions, and not to be gentle about them, but to go to their institutions and have real challenge, right? To say, wait, okay, time out. If we believe that we're educational institutions, if society is reliant on us to educate our students, how is it that we're the majority of credits that we deliver, we know have a 90% failure rate within 6 months? How can we live with ourselves for doing that? And by the way, there's a lot of angst about the state of our national discourse and our politics. Our founding fathers created the university system in the United States different from that existed in Europe, specifically to teach the liberal arts. The liberal arts have nothing to do with poetry, by the way, have nothing to do with the humanities. The mm-hmm. liberal arts were those disciplines that citizens and franchise citizens must master in order for them to enjoy the fruits of liberty. That's where liberal arts comes from. And if you do not have mastery of transferable practical knowledge, the founding fathers didn't use these terms. They used practical knowledge and useful knowledge, but not transferable, because that's a 20th century term. But they basically said, look, how could you have a person who is a farmer or a merchant or a doctor one day become a senator or a judge or a president the next day? If they are not trained in the liberal arts, the representative republic will not function. And so it is the job of universities to make our society function. And if you believe that you're teaching critical thinking in a broad based way, I have a wonderful challenge that anybody within the institution can give to their higher ups. Do an A/B test. Put our penicillin against your sugar pill and see what happens.
Thanks again to our guest, Ben Nelson. So, John, how did our interview with Ben impact your thinking about the work we're doing with Creative Next?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about how Ben and Minerva are shifting the model for education in really, you know, interesting and innovative ways. And I think, you know, at least some of the philosophy seems to me that they're technology enabled, but they're driven by outcomes, right? So they're driven by, you know, improving education, better retention, better understanding of subject matter, better interactions with professors, et cetera. And what I found, you know, inspiring about that is that this model, while it's you know, different from other university models, it feels like all of the component parts are there and sort of available, you know, sort of across various universities. So all universities have the power to change the way they're teaching students. It's sort of a matter of understanding and sort of the will to do it. In the same way, when we're looking at how we're interacting with smart machines or AI-driven software, I feel like we have the tools in front of us, you know, for this future of work, for this sort of collaborative human plus machine environment, and that it's a matter of, you know, in some ways of us understanding what those sort of new models will be, and you know, when they you know, when they present themselves, or when we, you know, as we're thinking about them, you know, that they may seem, you know, painfully obvious after the fact, right? And I can think of a lot of sort of business model shifts that have happened over the past decade, which now just seem sort of like sort of everyday occurrences. But, you know, thinking about what Ben and Minerva are doing. I really appreciate that, you know, that model shift and how they're drawing on sort of existing technology and research to create something new but familiar.
Yeah, definitely. For me, it made me think a lot about place in a couple of ways. I mean, one, you know, their approach, they have the students living centrally in one place, and also moving over the years, going to different cities, experiencing different parts of the world. But then that's juxtaposed with the professors who aren't physically located with the students for the most part, if at all. So they see the value, the power of saying, hey, we want our student body together to build a learning community. But we also want sort of specific professors who might be from anywhere in the world to come in and give their particular brand of knowledge without geographical constraints, which is interesting. Then too, with place, you know, located in the city as opposed to located on a campus. So really being thoughtful about environment and the design of space and place. It's something I'm going to take to all of the things that we're looking at with Creative Next.
Yeah, that's, I mean, those are, you know, critical elements and completely fascinating, I think, that understanding of, you know, how we're communicating and interacting with the places where we, you know, reside, where we learn, where we work, all very important, I think.
What did Ben say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
So I really keyed in on Ben's description of their integrated curriculum and just the idea that I forget the example exactly that he said, but it was something like in the real world, elements of, you know, sort of math and science are not separated from each other, right? These are separated practices from a subject matter standpoint, but they're intertwined in, you know, lots of different ways in the real world. And so how they had put together this integrated curriculum that draws upon, you know, sort of the knowledge gained in each area to, you know, enhance other areas. So I was lucky in that part of my liberal arts education was, you know, in a very similar way, an integrated curriculum for the first 2 years. So sort of the study of the classics and literature was integrated with the science curriculum. And I'm familiar with the concept, you know, and this, you know, in real world practice. And it's funny, after the first 2 years of my university experience, I had I sort of transferred schools within the university, and then went to a very much a piecemeal sort of, you know, you're fulfilling the requirements, but you're just, you know, doing a la carte kind of education. And that was a lot less rewarding. So to see that the integrated curriculum, which always made sense to me, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's right on, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I was really inspired by that. And even having, it sounds like they have even further integration, you know, than what I was exposed to during my, you know, education. But, you know, that's, I find that very exciting.
Definitely. Yeah, very, very much so. The biggest surprise for me was the way Ben framed prestige as the driver of higher education, as opposed to learning or something else. Just not something I was familiar with, and definitely has changed the way I think about higher education in general. Really eye-opening.
Obviously, you know, kind of a skeptical, somewhat cynical but real take, which is kind of a little bit of a bucket of cold water, I think.
So what did you learn from Ben that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Right. So, you know, based on that interview with Ben, you know, one of the elements that I'm sort of keeping an eye out for now is sort of practical ways that we can practically innovate. So And I think this sort of harkens back to what I was saying earlier, just about how the pieces, the elements of innovation are in front of us, right? So it's not as if online courses or anything revolutionary at this point. Like there are familiar tool sets for executing those things. And of course, Minerva has their special sauce, along the lines for student engagement and analytics and things like that. But I think what's sort of revolutionary is this, the way the elements are put together. And so for me, keeping an eye out for not looking in, out in the future, we're going to have all this wonderful stuff, right? That's just going to make everything so much easier. More looking at what things are working now. How can we integrate those things into our practices now? How can we change the way, our models work now? Right? That's where the sort of boots on the ground kind of practical innovation happens. And I know I'm sort of oversimplifying what's possible, and clearly there's plenty of research and hard work and practice that gets Minerva to be Minerva, right? Yeah. Not everybody can just sort of snap their fingers and do that. It takes a lot of careful preparation, but at the same time, the tools are in front of us. The models need to be examined, reimagined, and put to work.
Yeah, they do. And John, I want, and I mentioned this in the sort of, as I was giving analysis throughout the interview, but I want my children to attend Minerva. I mean, I'm besotted with the vision, and I think it's inspiring and incredible. And being able to go to Minerva, go to an organization with sort of the turning, the philosophy, the structure that Minerva has would be, I think, in their best interest. Now, what I discovered is, according to U.S. News and World Report, Minerva actually has the lowest acceptance rate of any university in the United States, including Harvard and all the big boys. Only 2% of applicants are accepted into Minerva. So that might be, it might be kind of like lottery ticket time for my kids to qualify and get into Minerva. But boy, I sure would like them to have that kind of an experience as opposed to the traditional, university fair. So now I'm thinking, how do I help make that happen? I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. Is that acceptance rate sort of based on, they must have a much smaller student population than say like your Harvard, right? So if a lot of people love the model and are applying, but they only accept X number of people, probably, not a huge amount.
John, you're a hell of a data analyst, because in fact, there are under 200 students accepted into the class each year.
Right. So each one represents, each 100 represents a, 1 percentage point. So, so there you go. They have, what is it? Can I do the math? Is that 10,000?
Just multiply by 50. Yeah.
10,000.
A little over 10,000. That's right.
So the hope would be that that in the future they would have more than 200. So by the time your kids are ready for college, hopefully they have, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 students. Increase that acceptance rate, because now they have more.
That's space. True. So that's true. There'll be more supply, but there might be more demand too. Maybe there'll be 1% as
Let's hope not.
Episode, we're going to finish up with the thing to think about. One question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, Ben suggested the real driver of higher education is prestige, not learning. What are some hidden drivers impacting your life, and how can you hack them to achieve your own better outcomes? Think about that for yourself, and feel free to tweet at us about it at GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at GoInvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum, they believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most, healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is, that's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish an article to extend and build upon each episode. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at dniemeyer, that's D-K-N-E-M-E-Y-E-R, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett, that's J-O-N-F-O-L-L-E-T-T. Our guest this episode is Ben Nelson. You can reach him on Twitter at Minerva Schools. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And of course, the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. Here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
As a millennial, I always believe in making a difference in the world and working to make an impact. And I always envision myself as doing something that changes or helps thousands of people in a few years.